aristocratic, and is for this reason generally styled the nobility's boxes, and although the box engaged for the two friends was sufficiently capacious to contain at least a dozen persons, it had cost less than would be paid at some of the French theatres for one admitting merely four occupants. Another motive had influenced Albert's selection of his seat. Who knew but that thus advantageously placed, he could not fail to attract the notice of some fair Roman, and an introduction might ensue that would procure him the offer of a seat in a carriage or a place in a princely balcony from which he might behold the gaieties of the carnival. These united considerations made Albert more lively and anxious to please than he had hitherto been. Totally disregarding the business of the stage, he leaned from his box and began attentively scrutinizing the beauty of each pretty woman, aided by a powerful lorgnette. But alas, this attempt to attract similar notice wholly failed. Not even curiosity had been excited, and it was but too apparent that the lovely creatures into whose graces he was desirous of stealing were all so much engrossed with themselves, their lovers, or their own thoughts, that they had not so much as remarked him or the pointing of his glass. Towards the close of the first act, the door of a box which had been hitherto vacant was opened. A lady entered to whom France had been introduced in Paris, where, indeed, he had imagined she still was. The quick eye of Albert caught the involuntary start with which his friend beheld the new arrival, and turning to him, he said hastily, "Do you know the female who has just entered the box?" "Yes." "What do you think of her?" "Oh, she is perfectly lovely." "What a complexion, and such magnificent hair! Is she French?" "No, a Venetian." "And her name is Countess G." "Ah, I know her by name," exclaimed Albert. "She is said to possess as much wit and cleverness as beauty. I was to have been presented to her when I met her at Madame Vifor's ball." "Shall I assist you in repairing your negligence?" asked Franz. "My dear fellow, are you really on such good terms with her as to venture to take me to her box?" "Why, I have only had the honour of being in her society and conversing with her 3 or 4 times in my life. But you know that even such an acquaintance as that might warrant my doing what you ask." At this instant the Countess perceived France and graciously waved her hand to him, to which he replied by a respectful inclination of the head. "Upon my word," said Albert, "you seem to be on excellent terms with the beautiful Countess." "You are mistaken in thinking so," returned Franz calmly, "but you merely fall into the same error which leads so many of our countrymen to commit the most egregious blunders. I mean that of judging the habits and customs of Italy and Spain by our Parisian notions." "Well, be it so," said Albert, "but the question for the present is, are you going to keep your promise of introducing me to the fair subject of our remarks?" "Certainly, directly the curtain falls on the stage." "What a confounded time this first act is about. I believe on my soul that they never mean to finish it." The curtain at length fell on the performances, to the infinite satisfaction of the Vicomte de Morcerf, who seized his hat, rapidly passed his fingers through his hair, arranged his cravat and wristbands, and signified to Franz that he was waiting for him to lead the way. France, who had mutely interrogated the Countess and received from her a gracious smile in token that he would be welcome, sought not to retard the gratification of Albert's eager impatience, but commenced at once the tour of the house, closely followed by Albert. They arrived at the Countess's box, and at the knock the door was immediately opened, and the young man who was seated beside the Countess in the front of the loge, in obedience to the Italian custom, instantly rose and surrendered his place to the strangers, who, in turn, would be expected to retire upon the arrival of other visitors. Franz presented Albert as one of the most distinguished young men of the day, both as regarded his position in society and extraordinary talents. Nor did he say more than the truth, for in Paris and the circle in which the Viscount moved, he was looked upon and cited as a model of perfection. Franz added that his companion, deeply grieved at having been prevented the honour of being presented to the Countess during her sojourn in Paris, was most anxious to make up for it, and had requested him, Franz, to remedy the past misfortune by conducting him to her box, and concluded by asking pardon for his presumption in having taken upon himself to do so. The Countess, in reply, bowed gracefully to Albert and extended her hand with cordial kindness to Franz. Then, inviting Albert to take the vacant seat beside her, she recommended Franz to take the next best, if he wished to view the ballet, and pointed to the one behind her own chair. Albert was soon deeply engrossed in discounting upon Paris and Paris matters, speaking to the Countess of the various persons they both knew there. Franz perceived how completely he was in his element, and, unwilling to interfere with the pleasure he so evidently felt, took up Albert's enormous lorgnette and began in his turn to survey the audience. Sitting alone in the front of a box immediately opposite but situated on the third row was a female of exquisite beauty, dressed in a Greek costume which, it was evident from the ease and grace with which she wore it, was her national attire. Behind her, but in deep shadow, was the outline of a male figure, but the features of this latter personage it was not possible to distinguish. Franz could not forbear breaking in upon the apparently interesting conversation passing between the Countess and Albert, to inquire of the former if she knew who was the fair Albanaise opposite, since beauty such as hers was well worthy of being remarked by either sex. "All I can tell you about her," replied the Countess, "is that she has been at Rome since the beginning of the season, for I saw her where she now sits the very first night of the theatre's opening, and since then she has never missed a performance, sometimes accompanied by the individual who is with her, and at others merely attended by a black servant. And what do you think of her personal appearance?" "Oh, I consider her perfectly lovely. She is just my idea of what Medora must have been." Franz and the Countess exchanged a smile, and then the latter resumed her conversation with Albert, while Franz returned to his previous survey of the house and company. The curtain rose on the ballet, which was one of those excellent specimens of the Italian school, admirably arranged and put on the stage by Henri, who has established for himself a great reputation throughout Italy for his taste and skill in the choreographic art. However much the ballet might have claimed his attention, Franz was too deeply occupied with the beautiful Greek to take any note of it, while she seemed to experience an almost childlike delight in watching it. Her eager, animated looks contrasting strongly with the utter indifference of her companion, who, during the whole time the piece lasted, never even moved, spite of the furious crashing din produced by the trumpets, cymbals, and Chinese bells made to produce their loudest sound from the orchestra. The apathetic companion of the fair Greek took no heed of the deafening sounds that prevailed, but was, as far as appearances might be trusted, enjoying soft repose and bright celestial dreams. The ballet at length came to a close, and the curtain fell amidst the loud, unanimous plaudits of an enthusiastic and delighted audience. Owing to the very judicious plan of dividing the two acts of the opera with a ballet, the pauses between the performances are very short, the singers in the opera having time to repose themselves and change their costume when necessary, while the dancers are executing their pirouettes and exhibiting their graceful steps. The overture to the second act began, and at the first sound of the leader's bow across his violin, Franz observed the sleeper slowly arise and approach the Greek girl, who turned round to say a few words to him, and then, leaning forward again on her box, she became as absorbed as before in what was going on. The countenance of the person who had addressed her remained so completely in the shade that though Franz tried his utmost, he could not distinguish a single feature. The curtain drew up, and the attention of Franz was attracted by the actors, and his eyes quitted their gaze at the box containing the Greek girl and her strange companion to watch the business of the stage. most of my readers are aware that the second act of Parisina opens with the celebrated and effective duet, in which Parisina, while sleeping, betrays to Azzo the secret of her love for Ugo. The injured husband goes through all the workings of jealousy until conviction seizes on his mind, and then, in a frenzy of his rage and indignation, he awakens his guilty wife to tell her he knows her guilt and to threaten her with his vengeance. This duet is one of the finest conceptions that has ever emanated from the fruitful pen of Donizetti. France now listened to it for the third time, yet its notes, so tenderly expressive and fearfully grand, as the wretched husband and wife give vent to their different griefs and passions, thrilled through the soul of France with an effect equal to his first emotions upon hearing it. Excited beyond his usual calm demeanor, Franz rose with the audience and was about to join the loud, enthusiastic applause that followed, but suddenly his purpose was arrested, his hands fell by his sides, and the half-uttered bravos expired on his lips. The occupant of the box in which the Greek girl sat appeared to share the universal animation that prevailed, for he left his seat to stand up in the front, so that his countenance being fully revealed, Franz had no difficulty in recognizing him as the mysterious inhabitant of Monte Cristo and the very same individual he had encountered the preceding evening in the ruins of the Colosseum, and whose voice and figure had seemed so familiar to him. All doubt of his identity was now at an end. His singular host evidently resided at Rome. The surprise and agitation occasioned by this full confirmation of France's former suspicion had no doubt imparted a corresponding expression to his features, for the Countess, after gazing with a puzzled look on his speaking countenance, burst into a fit of laughter and begged to know what had happened. "Madame la Comtesse," returned Franz, totally unheeding her raillery, "I asked you a short time since if you knew any particulars respecting the Albanian lady opposite. I must now beseech you to inform me who and what is her husband." "Nay," answered the Countess, "I know no more of him than yourself. Perhaps you never before remarked him?" "What a question! So truly French! Do you not know that we Italians have eyes only for the man we love?" "True," replied Franz. "All I can say," continued the Countess, taking up the lorgnette and directing it to the box in question, "is that the gentleman, whose history I am unable to furnish, seems to me as though he had just been dug up. He looks more like a corpse permitted by some friendly gravedigger to quit his tomb for a while and revisit this earth of ours than anything human. How ghastly pale he is!" "Oh, he is always as colourless as you now see him," said Franz. "Then you know him?" almost screamed the Countess. "Oh, pray do, for heaven's sake, tell us all about... Is he a vampire, or a resuscitated corpse, or what?" "I fancy I have seen him before, and I even think he recognizes me." "And I can well understand," said the Countess, shrugging up her beautiful shoulders, as though an involuntary shudder passed through her veins, "that those who have once seen that man will never be likely to forget him." The sensation experienced by Franz was evidently not peculiar to himself. Another and wholly uninterested person felt the same unaccountable awe and misgiving. "Well," inquired Franz, after the Countess had a second time directed her lorgnette at the loge of their mysterious vis-à-vis, "what do you think of our opposite neighbour?" "Why, that he is no other than Lord Ruthven himself in a living form." This fresh allusion to Byron drew a smile to Franz's countenance, although he could but allow that if anything was likely to induce belief in the existence of vampires, it would be the presence of such a man as the mysterious personage before him. "I must positively find out who and what he is," said Franz, rising from his seat. "No, no," cried the Countess, "you must not leave me. I depend upon you to escort me home. Oh, indeed, I cannot permit you to go." "Is it possible," whispered Franz, "that you entertain any fear?" "I'll tell you," answered the Countess. "Byron had the most perfect belief in the existence of vampires, and even assured me he had seen some. The description he gave me perfectly corresponds with the features and character of the man before us. Oh, it is the exact personification of what I have been led to expect. The coal-black hair, large, bright, glittering eyes, in which a wild, unearthly fire seems burning, the same ghastly paleness. Then observe, too, that the very female he has with him is altogether unlike all others of her sex. She is a foreigner, a stranger. Nobody knows who she is or where she comes from. No doubt she belongs to the same horrible race he does, and is, like himself, a dealer in magical arts. I entreat you not to go near him, at least tonight. And if tomorrow your curiosity still continues as great, pursue your researches if you will, but tonight you neither can or shall. For that purpose I mean to keep you all to myself." Franz protested he could not defer his pursuit till the following day, for many reasons. "Listen to me," said the Countess, "and do not be so very headstrong. I am going home. I have a party at my house tonight, and therefore cannot possibly remain till the conclusion of the opera. Now I cannot for one instant believe you so devoid of gallantry as to refuse a lady your escort when she even condescends to ask you for it." There was nothing else left for Franz to do but to take up his hat, open the door of the loge, and offer the Countess his arm. It was quite evident by the Countess's manner that her uneasiness was not feigned, and Franz himself could not resist a species of superstitious dread, so much the stronger in him as it arose from a variety of corroborating recollections, while the terror of the Countess sprung from an instinctive feeling originally created in her mind by the wild tales she had listened to till she believed them truths. Franz could even feel her arm tremble as he assisted her into the carriage. Upon arriving at her hotel, Franz perceived that she had deceived him when she spoke of expecting company. On the contrary, her own return before the appointed hour seemed greatly to astonish the domestics. "Excuse my little subterfuge," said the Countess in reply to her companion's half-reproachful observation on the subject, "but that horrid man had made me feel quite uncomfortable, and I longed to be alone that I might compose my startled mind." Franz essayed to smile. "Nay," said she, "smile not. It ill accords with the expression of your countenance, and I am sure it springs not from your heart. However, promise me one thing."
"What is it?"
"Promise me, I say. I will do anything you desire, except relinquish my determination of finding out who this man is. I have more reason than you can imagine for desiring to know who he is, from whence he came and whither he is going. Where he comes from, I am ignorant, but I can readily tell you where he is going to, and that is down below, without the least doubt."
"Let us only speak of the promise you wish me to make," said Franz.
"Well, then, you must give me your word to return immediately to your hotel, and make no attempt to follow this man tonight. There are certain affinities between the persons we quit and those we meet afterwards. For heaven's sake, do not serve as a conductor between that man and me. Pursue your chase after him tomorrow as eagerly as you please, but never bring him near me if you would not see me die of terror. And now, good night. Retire to your apartments, and try to sleep away all recollections of this evening. For my own part, I am quite sure I shall not be able to close my eyes." So saying, the Countess quitted France, leaving him unable to decide whether she were merely amusing herself at his expense, or that her fears and agitations were genuine. Upon his return to the hotel, Franz found Albert in his dressing-gown and slippers, listlessly extended on a sofa, smoking a cigar.
"My dear fellow," cried he, springing up, "is it really you?"
"Why, I did not expect to see you before tomorrow."
"My dear Albert," replied Franz, "I am glad of this opportunity to tell you once and for ever that you entertain a most erroneous notion concerning Italian females. I should have thought the continual failures you have met with in all your own love affairs might have taught you better by this time. Upon my soul, these women would puzzle the very devil to read them aright. Why, here they give you their hand, they press yours in return, they keep up a whispering conversation, permit you to accompany them home.
Why, if a Parisian were to indulge in a quarter of these marks of flattering attention, her reputation would be gone for ever. And the very reason why the females of this fine country put so little restraint on their words and actions is because they live so much in public and have really nothing to conceal. Besides, you must have perceived that the Countess was really alarmed. At what? At the sight of that respectable gentleman sitting opposite to us in the same loge as the lovely Greek girl? Now, for my part, I met them in the lobby after the conclusion of the piece, and hang me if I can guess where you took your notions of the other world from. I can assure you that this hobgoblin of yours is a deuced fine-looking fellow, admirably dressed. Indeed, I feel quite sure from the cut of his clothes they are made by a first-rate Paris tailor, probably Blin or Humann. He was rather too pale, certainly, but then, you know, paleness is always looked upon as a strong proof of aristocratical descent and distinguished breeding. Franz smiled, for he well remembered that Albert particularly prided himself on the entire absence of colour in his own complexion. "Well, that tends to confirm my own ideas," said Franz, "that the Countess's suspicions were destitute alike of sense and reason. Did he speak in your hearing, and did you catch any of his words?" "I did, but they were uttered in the Romaic dialect. I knew that from the mixture of Greek words. I don't know whether I ever told you that when I was at college I was rather strong in Greek." "He spoke the Romaic language, did he?"
"I think so."
"That settles it," murmured Franz. "'Tis he, past all doubt."
"What do you say?"
"Nothing, nothing. But tell me, what were you thinking about when I came in?"
"Oh, I was arranging a little surprise for you."
"Indeed? Of what nature? Why, you know, it is quite impossible to procure a carriage."
"Certainly.
And I also know that we have done all that human means afforded to endeavour to get one. Now then, in this difficulty, a bright idea has flashed across my brain."
Franz looked at Albert as though he had not much confidence in the suggestions of his imagination.
"Well now, what do you say to a cart?"
"I dare say such a thing might be had."
"Very possibly. And a pair of oxen?"
"As easily found as the cart."
"Then you see, my good fellow, with a cart and couple of oxen, our business can be arranged. The cart must be tastefully ornamented, and if you and I dress ourselves as Neapolitan reapers, we may get up a striking tableau after the manner of that splendid picture by Leopold Robert. It would add greatly to the effect if the Countess would join us in the costume of a peasant from Puzzoli or Sorrento. Our group would then be quite complete, more especially as the Countess is quite beautiful enough to represent the mother with child."
"Well," said Franz, "this time, Monsieur Albert, I am bound to give you credit for having hit upon a most capital idea,
and quite a national one, too," replied Albert, with gratified pride. "A mere mask borrowed from our own festivities.
Ha-ha, Monsieur le Romain, you thought to make us unhappy strangers trot at the heels of your processions like so many lazzaroni, because no carriages or horses are to be had in your beggarly city. But you don't know us. When we can't have one thing, we invent another. And have you communicated your triumphant idea to any person?
Only to our host. Upon my return home, I sent to desire he would come to me, and I then explained to him what I wished to procure. He assured me that nothing would be easier than to furnish all I desired. One thing I was sorry for. When I bade him have the horns of the oxen gilded, he told me there would not be time, as it would require 3 days to effect that. So you see, we must do without this little superfluity. And where is he now?"
"Who? Our host. Gone out in search of our equipage. By tomorrow it might be too late."
"Then he will be able to give us an answer tonight?"
"Oh, I expect him every minute."
At this instant the door opened and the head of Maitre Pastrini appeared.
"Permesso?" inquired he. "Certainly, certainly," cried Franz. "Come in, mine host."
"Now then," asked Albert eagerly, "have you found the desired cart and oxen?"
"Better than that," replied the Maitre Pastrini, with the air of a man perfectly well satisfied with himself. "Take care, my worthy host," said Albert. "Better is a sure enemy to well."
"Let your excellencies only leave the matter to me," returned Maitre Pastrini, in a tone indicative of unbounded self-confidence.
"But what have you done?" asked Franz. "Speak out. There's a worthy fellow.
Your excellencies are aware," responded the landlord, swelling with importance, "that the Count of Monte Cristo is living on the same floor with yourselves."
"I should think we did know it," exclaimed Albert, "since it is owing to that circumstance that we are packed into these small rooms like two poor students in the back streets of Paris.
Well, then, the Count of Monte Cristo, hearing of the dilemma in which you are placed, has sent to offer you seats in his carriage and two places at his windows in the Palace Rospoli."
The friends looked at each other with unutterable surprise.
"But do you think," asked Franz, "that we ought to accept such offers from a perfect stranger? What sort of person is this Count of Monte Cristo?" asked Franz of his host.
"A very great nobleman, but whether Maltese or Sicilian, I cannot exactly say. But this I know, that he is noble as a Borghese and rich as a gold mine."
"It seems to me," said Franz, speaking in an undertone to Albert, "that if this individual merited the high panegyrics of our landlord, he would have conveyed his invitation through another channel, and not permitted it to be brought to us in this unceremonious way. He would have written, or—" At this instant, someone knocked at the door.
"Come in," said Franz. A servant, wearing a livery of considerable style and richness, appeared at the threshold, and placing two cards in the landlord's hands, who forthwith presented them to the two young men, he said, "Please to deliver these from Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo to Monsieur le Vicomte Albert de Morcerf and Monsieur Franz Epinay. Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo," continued the servant, "begs these gentlemen's permission to wait upon them as their neighbor, and he will be honored by an intimation of what time they will please to receive him."
"Faith, France," whispered Albert, "there is not much to find fault with here."
"Tell the Count," replied France, "that we will do ourselves the pleasure of calling on him." The servant bowed and retired.
"That is what I call an elegant mode of attack," said Albert.
"You were quite correct in what you stated, Maitre Pastrini. The Count of Monte Cristo is unquestionably a man of first-rate breeding and knowledge of the world."
"Then you accept his offer?" said the host.
"Of course we do," replied Albert. "Still, I must own I am sorry to be obliged to give up the cart and the group of reapers. It would have produced such an effect. And were it not for the windows at the Palace Rospoli, by way of recompense for the loss of our beautiful scheme, I don't know but what I should have held on by my original plan. What say you, Franz?"
"Oh, I agree with you. The windows in the Palace Rospoli alone decided me."
The truth was that the mention of two places in the Palace Rospoli had recalled to Franz's mind the conversation he had overheard the preceding evening in the ruins of the Colosseum between the mysterious unknown and the Trastevere, in which the stranger in the cloak had undertaken to obtain the freedom of a condemned criminal. And if this muffled-up individual proved, as Franz felt sure he would, the same as the person he had just seen in the Teatro Argentino, then he should be able to establish his identity, and also to prosecute his researches respecting him with perfect facility and freedom. The next day must clear up every doubt, and unless his near neighbour and would-be friend, the Count of Monte Cristo, possessed the ring of Gigue, and by its power were able to render himself invisible, it was very certain he could not escape this time. 8 o'clock found Franz up and dressed, while Albert, who had not the same motives for early rising, was still profoundly asleep. The first act of Franz was to summon his landlord, who presented himself with his accustomed obsequiousness.
"Pray, Maitre Pastrini," asked Franz, "is not some execution appointed to take place today?"
"Yes, your excellence. But if your reason for inquiry is that you may procure a window to view it from, you are much too late."
"Oh, no,"
answered France. I had no such intention, and even if I had felt a wish to witness the spectacle, I might have done so from Monte Pincio, could I not?
Ah, exclaimed mine host, I did not think it likely your excellence would have chosen to mingle with such a rabble as are always collected on that hill, which, indeed, they consider as exclusively belonging to themselves.
Very possibly I may not go, answered France. But in case I feel disposed, give me some particulars of today's executions.
That happens just lucky, Your Excellence. Only a few minutes ago they brought me the tavolettas.
What are they?
Sort of wooden tablets, hung up at the corners of streets the evening before an execution, on which is pasted up a paper containing the names of the condemned persons, their crimes and mode of punishment. The reason for so publicly announcing all this is that all good and faithful Catholics may offer up their prayers for the unfortunate culprits, and above all, beseech of heaven to grant them a sincere repentance.
And these tablets are brought to you, that you may add your prayers to those of the faithful, are they? Asked France, somewhat incredulously.
How dear no, Your Excellence! I have not time for anybody's affairs but my own, and those of my honourable guests. But I make an agreement with the man who pastes up the papers, and he brings them to me as he would the playbills, that in case any person staying at my hotel should like to witness an execution, he may obtain every requisite information concerning the time and place, etc.
Upon my word, that is most delicate attention on your part, Maitre Pastrini, cried France.
Why, Your Excellence, returned the landlord, chuckling and rubbing his hands with infinite complacency, I think I may take upon myself to say I neglect nothing to deserve the support and patronage of the noble visitors to this poor hotel.
I see that plainly enough, my most excellent host, and you may rely upon my repeating so striking a proof of your attention to your guests wherever I go. Meanwhile, oblige me by a sight of one of these tavolettas.
Nothing can be easier than to comply with Your Excellency's wish, said the landlord, opening the door of the chamber. I have caused one to be placed on the landing close by your apartment.
Then, taking the tablet from the wall, he handed it to France, who read as follows. The public is informed that on Wednesday, February 23rd, being the first day of the carnival, two executions will take place in the Place del Popolo by order of the Tribunal della Rota of two individuals named Andrea Rondola and Peppino, otherwise called Rocca Priori. The former found guilty of the murder of a venerable and exemplary priest named Don Cesare Tolini, canon of the Church of Saint Jean de Latran, and the latter convicted of being an accomplice of the atrocious and sanguinary bandit Luigi Vampa and his troop. The first-named malefactor will be Mazzolato, the second culprit decapitato. The prayers of all good Christians are entreated for these unfortunate men, that it may please God to awaken them to a sense of their guilt, and to grant them a hearty and sincere repentance for their crimes. This was precisely what France had heard the evening before in the ruins of the Colosseum. No part of the program differed. The names of the condemned persons, their crimes and mode of punishment, all agreed with his previous information. In all probability, therefore, the Trastevere was no other than the bandit Luigi Vampa himself, and the man shrouded in the mantle, the same he had known as Sinbad the Sailor, but who, no doubt, was still pursuing his philanthropic expedition in Rome, as he had already done at Porto Vecchio and Tunis. Time was getting on, however, and France deemed it advisable to awaken Albert. But at the moment he prepared to proceed to his chamber, his friend entered the saloon in perfect costume for the day. The anticipated delights of the carnival had so run in his head as to make him leave his pillow long before his usual hour. "Now, my excellent Maitre Pastrini," said Franz, addressing his landlord, "since we are both ready, do you think we may proceed at once to visit the Count of Monte Cristo?"
"Most assuredly," replied he. "The Count of Monte Cristo is always an early riser, and I can answer for his having been up these 2 hours."
"Well, then, if it be so, are you ready, Albert?"
"Perfectly. Let us go and return our best thanks for his courtesy."
The landlord preceded the friends across the landing, which was all that separated them from the apartments of the Count, rang at a bell, and upon the door being opened by a servant, said, "I signori Francesi." The domestic bowed respectfully and invited them to enter. They passed through two rooms furnished with the style and luxury they had not calculated on finding under the roof of Maitre Pastrini, and were shown into an elegantly fitted-up saloon. The richest Turkey carpets covered the floor, and the softest and most inviting couches, bergère, and sofas offered their high-piled and yielding cushions to such as desired repose or refreshment. Splendid paintings by the first masters were ranged against the walls, intermingled with magnificent trophies of war, while heavy curtains of costly tapestry were suspended before the different doors of the room. "If your excellencies will please to be seated," said the man, "I will let Monsieur Lacan know you are here." And with these words he disappeared behind one of the tapestried portières. As the door opened, the sound of a guzla reached the ears of the young men, but was almost immediately lost, for the rapid closing of the door merely allowed one rich swell of harmony to enter the saloon. Franz and Albert looked inquiringly at each other, then at the gorgeous fittings-up of the apartment. All seemed even more splendid at a second view than it had done at their first rapid survey. "Well," said Franz to his friend, "what think you of all this?" "Why, upon my soul, my dear fellow, it strikes me our elegant and attentive neighbour must either be some successful stock-jobber who has speculated in the fall of the Spanish funds, or some prince travelling incog." "Hush, hush," replied Franz. "We shall ascertain who and what he is. He comes." As Franz spoke, he heard the sound of a door turning on its hinges, and almost immediately afterwards the tapestry was drawn aside, and the owner of all these riches stood before the two young men. Albert instantly rose to meet him, but Franz remained in a manner spellbound on his chair, for in the person of him who had just entered he recognized not only the mysterious visitant to the Colosseum and the occupant of the loge at the Sal Argentino, but also his singular host of Monte Cristo. 36. La Mazzolata. "Gentlemen," said the Count of Monte Cristo as he entered, "I pray you excuse me for suffering my visit to be anticipated, but I feared to disturb you by presenting myself earlier at your apartments. Besides, you sent me word you would come to me, and I have held myself at your disposal." "Franz and I have to thank you 1,000 times, Monsieur Lecomte," returned Albert. "You extricated us from a great dilemma, and we were on the point of inventing some very fantastic vehicle when your friendly invitation reached us." "Indeed," returned the Count, motioning the two young men to sit down. "It was the fault of that blockhead Pastrini that I did not sooner assist you in your distress. He did not mention a syllable of your embarrassment to me, although he knows that alone and isolated as I am, I seek every opportunity of making the acquaintance of my neighbors. As soon as I learned I could in any way assist you, I most eagerly seized the opportunity of offering my services." The two young men bowed. Franz had as yet found nothing to say. He had adopted no determination, and as nothing in the Count's manner manifested the wish that he should recognize him, he did not know whether to make any allusion to the past or wait until he had more proof. Besides, although sure it was he who had been in the box the previous evening, he could not be equally positive that he was the man he had seen at the Colosseum. He resolved, therefore, to let things take their course without making any direct overture to the Count. Besides, he had this advantage over him, that he was master of the Count's secret, whilst the Count had no hold on Franz, who had nothing to conceal. However, he resolved to lead the conversation to a subject which might possibly clear up his doubts. "Monsieur Lecomte," said he, "you have offered us places in your carriage and at your windows of the Rospoli Palace. Can you tell us where we can obtain a sight of the Place del Popolo?" "Ah," said the Count negligently, looking attentively at Morcerf, "is there not something like an execution upon the Place del Popolo?" "Yes," returned Franz, finding that the Count was coming to the point he wished. "Stay, I think I told my steward yesterday to attend to this. Perhaps I can render you this slight service also." He extended his hand and rang the bell thrice. "Did you ever occupy yourself," said he to France, "with the employment of time and the means of simplifying the summoning your servants? I have. When I ring once, it is for my valet, twice for my maître d'hôtel, thrice for my steward. Thus I do not waste a minute or a word. Here he is." A man of about 45 to 50 entered, exactly resembling the smuggler who had introduced Franz into the cavern, but he did not appear to recognize him. It was evident he had his orders. "Monsieur Bertuccio," said the Count, "have you procured me windows looking on the Place del Popolo, as I ordered you yesterday?" "Yes, Excellency," returned the steward, "but it was very late." "Did I not tell you I wish for one?" replied the Count, frowning. "And your Excellency has one, which was let to Prince Lobanieff. But I was obliged to pay 100." "That will do, that will do, Monsieur Bertuccio. Spare these gentlemen all such domestic arrangements. You have the window, that is sufficient. Give orders to the coachman, and be in readiness on the stairs to conduct us to it." The steward bowed and was about to quit the room. "Ah!" continued the Count, "be good enough to ask Pastrini if he has received the Tavoletta, and if he can send us an account of the execution." "There is no need to do that," said Franz, taking out his tablets, "for I saw the account and copied it down." "Very well. You can retire, Maître Bertuccio. Let us know when breakfast is ready. These gentlemen," added he, turning to the two friends, "will, I trust, do me the honour to breakfast." "But, Monsieur le Comte," said Albert, "we shall abuse your kindness." "Not at all. On the contrary, you will give me great pleasure. You will, one or other of you, perhaps both, return it to me at Paris. Maître Bertuccio, lay covers for 3. He took Francis' tablets out of his hand. "We announce," he read in the same tone with which he would have read a newspaper, "that today, the 23rd of February, will be executed Andrea Rondolo, guilty of murder of the person of the respectable and venerated Don Cesar Torlini, canon of the church Saint-Jean de Latran, and Peppino, called Rocco Priori, convicted of complicity with the detestable bandit Luigi Vampa and the men of his troop." "The first will be Mazzolato, the second Decapitato." "Yes," continued the Count, "it was at first arranged in this way, but I think since yesterday some change has taken place in the order of the ceremony." "Really?" said Franz. "Yes. I passed the evening at the Cardinal Rospigliosi's, and there mention was made of something like a pardon for one of the two men." "For Andrea Rondolo?" asked Franz. "No," replied the Count carelessly. "For the other." He glanced at the tablets as if to recall the name. "For Peppino, called Rocco Priori. You are thus deprived of seeing a man guillotined, but the Mazzolato still remains, which is a very curious punishment when seen for the first time, and even the second, whilst the other, as you must know, is very simple. The mandaïa never fails, never trembles, never strikes 30 times ineffectually, like the soldier who beheaded the Comte de Chalais, and to whose tender mercy Richelieu had doubtless recommended the sufferer." "Ah," added the Count in a contemptuous tone, "do not tell me of European punishments. They are in the infancy, or rather the old age, of cruelty." "Really, Monsieur le Comte," replied Franz, "one would think that you had studied the different tortures of all the nations of the world." "There are at least few that I have not seen," said the Count coldly. "And you took pleasure in beholding these dreadful spectacles?" "My first sentiment was horror, the second indifference, the third curiosity." "Curiosity, that is a terrible word. Why so?" "In life our greatest preoccupation is death. Is it not then curious to study the different ways by which the soul and body can part, and how, according to their different characters, temperaments, and even the different customs of their countries, individuals bear the transition from life to death, from existence to annihilation? As for myself, I can assure you of one thing. The more men you see die, the easier it becomes to die. And, in my opinion, death may be a torture, but it is not an expiation." "I do not quite understand you," replied Franz. "Pray explain your meaning, for you excite my curiosity to the highest pitch." "Listen," said the Count, and deep hatred mounted to his face as the blood would to the face of any other. If a man had by unheard-of and excruciating tortures destroyed your father, your mother, your mistress, in a word, one of those beings who, when they are torn from you, leave a desolation, a wound that never closes in your breast, do you think the reparation that society gives you sufficient by causing the knife of the guillotine to pass between the base of the occiput and the trapezial muscles of the murderer, because he who has caused us years of moral sufferings undergoes a few moments of physical pain? Yes, I know, said France, that human justice is insufficient to console us. She can give blood in return for blood, that is all. But you must demand from her only what it is in her power to grant. I will put another case to you, continued the Count, that where society, attacked by the death of a person, avenges death by death. But are there not 1,000 tortures by which a man may be made to suffer without society taking the least cognizance of them, or offering him even the insufficient means of vengeance of which we have just spoken? Are there not crimes for which the impalement of the Turks, the augers of the Persians, the stake and the brand of the Iroquois Indians are inadequate tortures, and which are unpunished by society? Answer me, do not these crimes exist? Yes, answered France, and it is to punish them that duelling is tolerated. Ah, duelling, cried the Count, a pleasant manner, upon my soul, of arriving at your end, when that end is vengeance. A man has carried off your mistress. A man has seduced your wife. A man has dishonored your daughter. He has rendered the whole life of one who had the right to expect from heaven that portion of happiness God has promised to every one of his creatures, an existence of misery and infamy. And you think you are avenged because you send a ball through the head or pass a sword through the breast of that man who has planted madness in your brain and despair in your heart, without recollecting that it is often he who comes off victorious from the strife, absolved of all crimes in the eyes of the world? No, no, continued the Count. Had I to avenge myself, it is not thus I would take revenge. Then you disapprove of dueling. You would not fight a duel? Asked Albert, in his turn, astonished at this strange theory. Oh, yes, replied the Count. Understand me. I would fight a duel for a trifle, for an insult, for a blow, and the more so that, thanks to my skill in all bodily exercises and the indifference to danger I have gradually acquired, I should be almost certain to kill my man. Oh, I would fight for such a cause, but in return for a slow, profound, eternal torture, I would give back the same were it possible. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, as the Orientalists say. Our masters in everything, those favored creatures who have formed for themselves a life of dreams and a paradise of realities. But, said Franz to the Count, with this theory, which renders you at once judge and executioner of your own cause, it would be difficult to adopt a course that would forever prevent your falling under the power of the law. Hatred is blind, rage carries you away, and he who pours out vengeance runs the risk of tasting a bitter draught. Yes, if he be poor and inexperienced, not if he be rich and skillful. Besides, the worst that could happen to him would be the punishment of which we have already spoken, and which the philanthropic French Revolution has substituted for being torn to pieces by horses or broken on the wheel. What matters this punishment as long as he is avenged? On my word, I almost regret that in all probability this miserable Peppino will not be decapitato, as you might have had an opportunity then of seeing how short a time the punishment lasts, and whether it is worth even mentioning. But really, this is a most singular conversation for the carnival, gentlemen. How did it arise? Ah, I recollect. You asked for a place at my window. You shall have it. But let us first sit down to table, for here comes the servant to inform us breakfast is ready. As he spoke, a servant opened one of the four doors of the salon, saying, Al suo commodo. The two young men rose and entered the breakfast room.
During the meal, which was excellent and admirably served, Franz looked repeatedly at Albert in order to remark the impression which he doubted not had been made on him by the words of their entertainer. But whether with his usual carelessness he had paid but little attention to him, whether the explanation of the Count of Monte Cristo with regard to duelling had satisfied him, or whether the events which Franz knew of had a double effect on him alone, he remarked that his companion did not pay the least regard to them, but on the contrary ate like a man who for the last 4 or 5 months had been condemned to partake of Italian cookery, that is, the worst in the world. As for the Count, he just touched the dishes. He seemed as if he fulfilled the duties of an entertainer by sitting down with his guests and awaited their departure to be served with some strange or more delicate food. This brought back to Franz, in spite of himself, the recollection of the terror with which the Count had inspired the Countess G, and her firm conviction that the man in the opposite box was a vampire. At the end of the breakfast, Franz took out his watch. "Well," said the Count, "what are you doing?" "You must excuse us, Monsieur le Comte," returned Franz, "but we have still much to do." "What may that be? We have no disguises, and it is absolutely necessary to procure them. Do not concern yourself about that. We have, I think, a private room in the Place del Popolo. I will have whatever costumes you choose brought to us, and you can dress there."
"After the execution?" cried Franz. "Before or after, which you please. Opposite the scaffold?" "The scaffold forms part of the fête." "Monsieur le Comte, I have reflected on the matter," said Franz. "I thank you for your courtesy, but I shall content myself with accepting a place in your carriage and at your window at the Rospoli Palace, and I leave you at liberty to dispose of my place at the Place del Popolo." "But I warn you, you will lose a very curious sight," returned the Count. "You will relate it to me," replied Franz, "and the recital from your lips will make as great an impression on me as if I had witnessed it. I have more than once intended witnessing an execution, but I have never been able to make up my mind." "And you, Albert?"
"I," replied the Viscount, "I saw Castaing executed, but I think I was rather intoxicated that day, for I had quitted college the same morning, and we had passed the previous night at a tavern. Besides, it is no reason, because you have not seen an execution at Paris, that you should not see one anywhere else. When you travel, it is to see everything. Think what a figure you will make when you are asked, 'How do they execute at Rome?' and you reply, 'I do not know.' And besides, they say that the culprit is an infamous scoundrel who killed with a log of wood a worthy canon who had brought him up like his own son. Diable! When a churchman is killed, it should be with a different weapon than a log, especially when he has behaved like a father. If you went to Spain, would you not see the bullfights? Well, suppose it is a bullfight you are going to see. Recollect the ancient Romans of the circus, and the sports where they killed 300 lions and 100 men. Think of the 80,000 applauding spectators, the sage matrons who took their daughters, and the charming vestals who made with the thumb of their white hands the fatal sign that said, 'Come, dispatch this man already nearly dead.'" "Shall you go then, Albert?" asked Franz. "Ma foi, yes. Like you, I hesitated, but the Count's eloquence decides me."
"Let us go, then," said Franz, "since you wish it. But on our way to the Place del Popolo, I wish to pass through the Rue de Cour. Is this possible, Monsieur le Comte?"
"On foot, yes. In a carriage, no."
"I will go on foot, then."
"Is it important that you should pass through this street?"
"Yes, there is something I wish to see."
"Well, we will pass by the Rue de Cour. We will send the carriage to wait for us on the Piazza del Popolo by the Strada del Babuino, for I shall be glad to pass myself through the Rue de Cour to see if some orders I have given have been executed."
"Excellency," said a servant, opening the door, "a man in the dress of a penitent wishes to speak to you."
"Ah, yes," returned the Count. "I know who he is, gentlemen. Will you return to the salon? You will find on the center table some excellent Havana cigars. I will be with you directly." The young men rose and returned into the salon, whilst the Count, again apologizing, left by another door. Albert, who was a great smoker, and who had considered it no small sacrifice to be deprived of the cigars of the Café de Paris, approached the table and uttered a cry of joy at perceiving some veritable pueros.
"Well," asked Franz, "what think you of the Count of Monte Cristo?"
"What do I think?" said Albert, evidently surprised at such a question from his companion. "I think that he is a delightful fellow, who does the honours of his table admirably, who has travelled much, read much, is, like Brutus of the Stoic school, and, moreover," added he, sending a volume of smoke up towards the ceiling, "that he has excellent cigars."
Such was Albert's opinion of the Count, and as Franz well knew that Albert professed never to form an opinion except upon long reflection, he made no attempt to change it. "But," said he, "did you remark one very singular thing?"
"What? How attentively he looked at you."
"At me?"
"Yes."
Albert reflected. "Ah," replied he, sighing, "that is not very surprising. I have been more than a year absent from Paris, and my clothes are of a most antiquated cut. The Count takes me for a provincial. The first opportunity you have, undeceive him, I beg, and tell him I am nothing of the kind."
Franz smiled. An instant later, the Count entered. "I am now quite at your service, gentlemen," said he. "The carriage is going one way to the Place del Popolo, and we will go another, and, if you please, by the Rue du Cours. Take some more of these cigars, Monsieur de Morcerf."
"With all my heart," returned Albert. "These Italian cigars are horrible. When you come to Paris, I will return all this. I will not refuse. I intend going there soon, and since you allow me, I will pay you a visit. Come, let us set off."
All three descended. The coachman received his master's orders and drove down the Via del Babuino. Whilst the three gentlemen walked towards the Place d'Espagne and the Via Frattina, which led directly between the Fiano and Rospoli palaces, all Franz's attention was directed towards the windows of that last palace, for he had not forgotten the signal agreed upon between the man in the mantle and the Trastevere peasant.
"Which are your windows?" asked he of the Count, with as much indifference as he could assume.
"The three last," returned he, with a negligence evidently unaffected, for he could not imagine with what intention the question was put.
Franz glanced rapidly towards the three windows. The side windows were hung with yellow damask, and the centre one with white damask and a red cross. The man in the mantle had kept his promise to the Trastevere, and there could now be no doubt that he was the Count. The three windows were still untenanted. Preparations were making on every side. Chairs were placed, scaffolds were raised, and windows were hung with flags. The masks could not appear, the carriages could not move about, but the masks were visible behind the windows, the carriages, and the doors. Franz Albert and the Count continued to descend the Rue de Cour. As they approached the Place del Popolo, the crowd became more dense, and above the heads of the multitude, two objects were visible. The obelisk surmounted by a cross which marks the centre of the place, and before the obelisk, at the point where the three streets del Babuino, del Corso and di Ripetta meet, the two uprights of the scaffold, between which glittered the curved knife of the Mandilla. At the corner of the street they met the Count's steward, who was awaiting his master. The window, let at an exorbitant price which the Count had doubtless wished to conceal from his guests, was on the second floor of the great palace, situated between the Rue del Babuino and the Monte Pincio. It consisted, as we have said, of a small dressing room opening into a bedroom, and when the door of communication was shut, the inmates were quite alone. On two chairs were laid as many elegant costumes of paillasse, in blue and white satin.
"As you left the choice of your costumes to me," said the Count to the two friends, "I have had these brought, as they will be the most worn this year, and they are most suitable on account of the confetti, sweetmeats, as they do not show the flower."
Franz heard the words of the Count but imperfectly, and he perhaps did not fully appreciate this new attention to their wishes, for he was wholly absorbed by the spectacle that the Piazza del Popolo presented, and by the terrible instrument that was in the centre. It was the first time Franz had ever seen a guillotine. We say guillotine because the Roman mandaïa is formed on almost the same model as the French instrument. The knife, which is shaped like a crescent that cuts with the convex side, falls from a less height, and that is all the difference.
The prisoners, transported the previous evening from the Carcere Nuovo to the little church of Santa Maria del Popolo, had passed the night each accompanied by two priests in a chapel closed by a grating, before which were two sentinels relieved at intervals. A double line of carbineers placed on each side of the door of the church reached to the scaffold and formed a circle around it, leaving a path about 10 feet wide and around the guillotine a space of nearly 100 feet. All the rest of the place was paved with heads. Many women held their infants on their shoulders, and thus the children had the best view. The Montepincio seemed a vast amphitheatre filled with spectators. The balconies of the two churches at the corner of the Rue del Babuino and the Rue di Ripetto were crammed. The steps even seemed a parti-coloured sea that was impelled towards the portico. Every niche in the wall held its living statue. What the Count said was true. The most curious spectacle in life is that of death. And yet, instead of the silence and the solemnity demanded by the occasion, a noise of laughter and jest arose from the crowd. It was evident that this execution was, in the